And last speaker is Andrew Drinan. Andrew is an associate professor here in the School of Biosciences, but very importantly for today, he's also the director of our University of Melbourne Herbarium. Andrew did his PhD here at Melbourne with me, actually, as his supervisor, so I was very, very young at the time. And during that PhD, he spent a year doing research in Montreal, in Canada, to learn various techniques that he's since employed to study the morphology and development of plants. He did a postdoc at the Chicago Field Museum, where he did most of his work on fossils. So Andrew is both a plant morphologist, a plant systematist, he understands about classification, but he's also a paleobotanist, and he did some discovered and described some very interesting, very early flowering plant fossils. I think I could summarise Andrew as saying he has a real interest in the evolution of land plants, and that's from mosses right up through our gymnosperms to our flowering plants. But it is today that you're going to mostly wear, I think, the director of the herbarium's hat and link the science of classification with what we've learned about the system garden design. I think that's what you're going to do.
Yeah, thanks, Pauline. You described me as a total dilettante. That's probably true also. So we're talking here about the system garden, and the very name of the system garden implies a system and a system of classification. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time today talking about what are these systems of classification, and where do they come from? How did we get to them? And the system that the system garden used, and then what happened after that? And what's the system that's out there if you look in the system garden today? And indeed, what's happened in plant systematics and plant classification subsequent to that? And indeed, what's happening in plant classification today? So I'm going to skip through it fairly quickly because there's a lot to cover in half an hour. And I'm not going to talk so much about the classification, but it's going to be a talk a lot about people because the classifications are there and they're interesting. But as we know, it's the people doing the classifications that tend to be interesting. And McCoy, of course, was as interesting as his system, our system garden. Well, we classify for a number of reasons. We have this innate love of order and we like to have things classified. Classifications help us to identify things, and classifications contain a certain amount of information. So they were the primary reasons why we do it. It's not something that's new. It goes back to the ancients. Theostrophus, who is a student of Aristotle, we put as the sort of earliest modern person, 300 BC. Through the interest in philosophy, and then also in the practical aspects of plants. Pliny the Elder, we know of him as his encyclopedia of everything natural history, multi-volume work, which he devoted something like 7 volumes to plants before he perished in the eruption of Vesuvius. Also in the first century AD, Dioscorides, a famous Roman military surgeon, put together this Materia Medica, everything about medicinal plants, which was current for something like 1,500 years. And the medieval herbalists followed in that tradition, but really didn't add to it. It wasn't until really the Renaissance or a little bit later that we started to get the beginnings of real classifications. And I've just listed there a couple of key people, the Italian botanist Zezalpino, very famous English botanist James Ray. This coincided with the discovery of the New World and the introduction of a whole lot of new plants that needed to be catalogued and arranged, and that this needed some sort of classification to deal with that. But we really date our modern classifications starting with Linnaeus, a very famous Swedish natural historian, but we think of him, of course, here today as a botanist. He was the founder of modern taxonomy and modern classification. Before Linnaeus, plants really weren't classified, and they didn't really have names. They had descriptions. And as more plants became discovered, the descriptions became longer and longer. So we had the name of a plant that went, you know, something like this. I'm not going to read it out in the Latin, but it translates to a plantain with pudescent, ovate, lanceolate leaves, etc. We now know that name as Plantagomedia, because in his species plant, Tarum, he established or entrenched this modern binomial system where we recognise the naming of organisms by genus name and a species name. Are very convenient. The famous English botanist, William Stern, who was a biographer of Linnaeus, I heard him give a talk once, claiming that it was because, not for purposes of nomenclature, but purely for ones of frugalness, that in war-ravaged Sweden, paper was hard to come by, and it was much easier to write just the two names than the whole description. But nonetheless, it was one that was very affected and it had stuck. But even before 1753, in Species Plantarum, Linnaeus had published the Systema Naturae in 1735, a classification of everything, plants, animals, and minerals. Linnaeus did the lot. He had a special interest in plants, his passion, birds and insects, and he was going to leave some of the other things, like the fishes, to his colleague Petrus Artedi. But unfortunately, Artedi died beforehand, and Linnaeus was left to finish off the classification of the fishes. And it's interesting that, in terms of longevity, Artedi's classification of the fishes has been much more successful than Linnaeus's classification of the plants. Systema Naturae in 1735 arranged the plants into a, well, organisms, but we're interested in plants here, into a taxonomic hierarchy of classification. He recognised 24 classes of plants, and there are about 800 genera. So here's one of the pages out of the vegetable kingdom part of Systema Naturae, is the page, and here's its translation. It's known as the key to the sexual system of plants. Linnaeus scandalised Swedish society with this very notion that plants had sex. And not just the notion that plants had sex, but the explicit way that he put it in his classification. So he talked about, here's the translation, he talked about this as the marriages of plants, and that plants had either public marriages, where the flowers were very visible, you can see it here, publicae, and or clandestine marriages where the flowers were very visible, and even down to whether the male and female parts were in the same flower, husband and wife have the same bed. And we can see that here, mariti et uxeres, husband and wife. It's sort of very quaint. Swedes have a reputation, of course, and that whether Linnaeus started it. But once he got down to those main groups, he went straight to characters like the numbers of stamens in the flower. So we see these classifications into 24 classes based on flowers with one stamen, two stamen, the triandria, three stamens, four stamens, etc. Now, it turns out that this sort of classification is very artificial and not particularly useful, because the number of stamens in a flower doesn't really define anything. And so the groups of plants that were there in Linnaeus' classification weren't very, very useful. Odd sort of plants went together. In fact, I'm going to read from just a quote from a textbook, which I'll come back to later. It's an old textbook. There are two systems pursued in the arrangement of plants. One is called the artificial method, and the other the natural method. In artificial methods, one or two organs are selected in an arbitrary manner, and they are taken as the means for forming classes and orders, while in the natural methods, plants are grouped according to their alliance in all their important characters. When a student knows the artificial class and order to which a plant is to be referred, he does not thereby become acquainted with its structure and properties. When he determines, on the other hand, the place of a plant in the natural system, he necessarily acquires a knowledge of its structural relations and its affinities. Hence, the knowledge of the latter system is what must be the aim of every botanist. And of course, we think of that now as a very important thing, that our classifications need to reflect some sort of affinity, and that affinity tells us something about those organisms. As to what those natural relationships were when they were first discovered, here's a quote from the same book. In examining the vegetable kingdom, we observe that the individuals composing it are formed by the Almighty in accordance with a principle of order as well as a principle of special adaptation. So these were the orders of creation, were the original natural things to be gathered. So it turned out that Linnaeus' system is very good for identifying plants, but it's not so much for telling anything more about it. After Linnaeus came a series of botanists and their classifications, which were dealing with these, describing the natural order of creation and putting things that really were alike together. I'm just going to mention a few of the key ones. Antoine Laurent de Jussieu. The de Jussieus were a whole family of French botanists, really heavy hitters in Paris at the time. keepers of the garden of the Jardin des Plantes, the Botanic Gardens. I think Laurent, Anton Laurent, this year started the Natural History Museum in Paris. But they were hugely important. This publication of Genera Plantarum in 1789 was what really established the modern family classification of plants. Dujardin had almost 100 orders. They're comparable to the families now, of which they weren't all his. He'd got a few from one of Linnaeus's earlier publications, a few from Bernard Dujardin, his uncle, a few from Adamson. He had about 34 of his own. At the start of the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature, which was the sort of officialization of all plant names, 76 of those 97 families were conserved. So it just shows that how important this that Dujardin was in these early stages. Then there was the Decandolles, another family of botanists, the generations of them. They were Swedish, followed on from Dujardin, Theorie Elementaire de Botanique, 1813. John Lindley, a very famous English botanist, horticulturalist, gardener. He was appointed a professor at the University of London, I think. The Vegetable Kingdom, 1846, another very influential book at the time. And then followed on at the same time, but publishing it then a little bit later, two really heavy hitters of the English botanical scene, George Bentham and Joseph Dalton Hooker. And they published the Genera Plantarum over three volumes from about 1860 through the 1880s. Hooker was the keeper of the botanic gardens at Kew, a son of a very famous botanist himself. He was a heavy hitter in the establishment scene. George Bentham was the nephew of the famous utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham. And when Jeremy Bentham died, he left George Bentham his estate, and that allowed him to work on plant systematics, along with logic and mathematics and many other things. He was seen as the preeminent systematist of England at that time. He'd already written the Handbook of the British Flora, which was hugely successful, and Flora Australiensis, with which Mueller had quite a lot to do with. So they were hugely influential. So this is the sort of era at which the system garden was started in 1856. So McCoy had, and we know from this plant list of 1865, which has already been mentioned. So of all these classifications of these eminent people that McCoy had to deal with, which one did he choose? As we know now, he chose John Hutton Balfour. Well, knock me down with a feather. Who is that? In fact, if you go to plant classifications entry in Wikipedia, there's all these ones I've just mentioned, a whole lot of other lesser luminaries, and John Hutton Balfour's classification doesn't even get mentioned. Which is just as well, because Hooker wasn't, McCoy wasn't using Wikipedia. But Balfour does have an entry in Wikipedia, and it's quite a prominent one. But he, of course, did the next best thing. He wrote the article on botany for Encyclopaedia Britannica in 1854, which was probably the biggest thing when there was no Wikipedia. And that classification, which is also in his, he wrote numerous textbooks, the outlines of botany, it's replicated there. He was also a heavy hitter. He was the professor of botany at Glasgow University and then at Edinburgh. He was the keeper of botany at Edinburgh University. He got both of those latter positions after a sort of protracted political battle with J.D. Hooker. And if you can go toe-to-toe with J.D. Hooker and win, you're no slouch. You certainly have some street cred. And he wrote a number of very influential botanical textbooks. So why is it that McCoy chose this classification? Well, we don't know. And Glenn Pascoe, in the little booklet on the system garden, goes through some of the possibilities in a very beautiful way. I don't know whether that's available. Is that available openly? There is a PDF copy, so it would be great if that was available, because it's fantastic. It's certainly known that McCoy had a copy of the Outlines of Botany, 1854, the first edition. He brought that with him. Whether he had the second edition is unclear, but he probably did, if it's the plant list of 1865. It's interesting that he recommended John Lindley's Vegetable Kingdom to his students, not the Outlines of Botany. I'm not quite sure why that would be. But of course, the other possibility is that he had a copy of it, and after all, McCoy was a zoologist, and there is a chance that one plant classification was as good as any other. And in that case, he was probably right, because they were all pretty much about the same. I actually think he made a really good choice. And when you flick through the textbook of Balfour, and in fact those two quotes I read out earlier were for Balfour's textbook, it's a really beautiful little textbook. Here's the title page for the 1862 version of Outlines of Botany, and here's the first page of Balfour's classification, and you can see here that he starts with Ranunculaceae, and he goes on very soon into Magnoliaceae. And for any of you who did your undergraduate studies in botany in the 1970s like me, or perhaps earlier, this will be something that's very familiar. It's the sort of the essence of the Renalian classification, with the primitive flowers, many parted, free things at the start. And when you look through a Balfour's classification, I'd be very happy to send any of my students out to walk around the garden laid out in Balfour's classification. I'd be happy if they went out and had a look at anything. Of course, a lot else was happening around that time. Of course, Charles Darwin had published The Origin of Species in 1859, The Theory of Evolution by Natural Selection. Like Lamarck, he believed in the inheritance of acquired characteristics and that natural reflections, classifications should reflect genealogy and descent, not the natural order of creation. In fact, when you go to Balfour's textbook, he even talks a little bit about Lamarck's and Darwin's classifications, even though I don't think he was enamored by them. So Lamarck started a theory that all organic beings have descended from a primary living cell. A similar view, although different in some respects, has been lately advocated by Charles Darwin. The species are now undergoing changes as their predecessors have done and are subject to a constant struggle for life, etc. He goes on then to say, in the present species of the globe, we do not see facts to corroborate this theory. The theory is now being tested, and before long, its merits and demerits will be fully known. In the meantime, naturalists are divided in opinion, and many hold that Darwin's views are both erroneous and dangerous. There can be no doubt that as regards man at a zoological and psychological point of view, the theory is untenable. So, you know, for someone who was fence-sitting probably on the wrong side of the fence, that was very generous to give that much time to Lamarck and Darwin in a textbook. And I think McCoy's choice of Balfour was probably based on a huge respect. Balfour, of course, was also hugely well known and respected in England, and he was recommended, I think, by people who were also friends of McCoy. So there were those interactions. How much McCoy brought into the evolutionary debate, I've got no idea. But then we had, along with Darwin, Haeckel's trees of life portrayed in these branching diagrams. It wasn't for some decades until these evolutionary ideas made their way into plant classifications. And I just want to mention a couple of important ones, because of course there were many of them. Every man and his dog produced a classification. Two German botanists, Engler and Prandtl, around the turn of the 1800s to 1900s, published a volume. It was really Engler's classification and Prandtl collaborated on many aspects of it. And these were one of the first classifications to really specify a hypothesis of what the primitive plants were, where they'd come from, and what the primitive characters were. So they made the hypothesis that these primitive flowers, simple flowered plants like the catkingberry plants, were primitive, and they had their origins in the gymnospermous plants of the Neteli. So these were explicitly evolutionary with explicit primitive characters. But it wasn't entirely novel. They followed on from their German colleagues Endlicher and Eichler, who also put the apetalous plants at the start of their so-called natural classification. So these were sort of transitional, but definitely with that evolutionary slant. Volumes of this continued to be edited right up until 1964. It was a hugely detailed work, hugely successful, and it formed the basis of the laying out of specimens of most of the non-British European herbaria. So Engler and Prandtl classification was hugely important. In the English-speaking world, the baton was taken up by an American botanist, Charles Bessey. And he pretty much modified Bentham and Hooker's classification. His specific ideas of the primitive flower were large, insect-pollinated, many parts with spiral phyllotaxy, right? Things we associate with magnolia. In fact, he hypothesized the magnolia as the primitive flower. But also origin in gymnospermous plants. And at the time, people were enamored with fossil plants that were being discovered that were sort of not quite cycads, but ancient cycad-like plants. It turns out these ancient cycad plant-like plants have nothing to do with the story at all, but it was prominent at the time. So Bessey's classification was portrayed like this. Again, these branching diagrams with families evolving from other families, and it became known as the basis of what was called the Rennalian classification, because here at the base of the old group, the Rennalies, which was, you know, magnolias and the buttercups and things like that. Now, he published that just before his death in 1915. This is the important one for us because the idea and the concept was fully developed by another American botanist, Arthur Cronquist, in the late 1960s, and he published his sort of definitive classification in 1981, Cronquist classification, where he formalized Bessey's things into the major subclasses. So here again, here are the Rennalias, the Magnolias at the base, with the other subclasses arranged in something, and the monocots, which are implicit, although not in his diagrams, come from the magnolias. So this is Cronquist, and I wanted to mention also, along with Cronquist, a Russian botanist, Armen Taktajan. They were very close friends. They had very similar ideas. American herbaria followed Cronquist, but if you went to the Soviet Union, the herbaria were laid out according to the systems of Taktajan. I used to have this great photograph of these two giants of plant systematics, Taktajan and Cronquist, standing there with an absolute minnow of plant classifications standing in the middle. That was me. And I thought at the time when that was taken, like about the 1980s, that would come in really handy one day as a really useful photograph. And I've never used it. And in fact, for this talk, I hunted around and I couldn't find it. Cronquist classification is important to us because it's the one that forms the basis of the Flora of Australia project and also the Flora of Victoria. And many English-speaking herbaria, typically in the non-British world. So if you go to down the road to the National Herbarium of Victoria, the herbarium is laid out according to Cronquist's classification. System Garden in the 1990s. Probably events never to be happen again, I don't know, but certainly one of them happened in the 1990s. One of them was we managed to regain some turf for the system garden with the demolition of the registrar's house. Not a lot, because Property and Campus Services grabbed a chunk of it for a work site, but we got some of it back. And there was also a little bit of a redesign of the system garden to upgrade the system of classification. And the system of classification that was put together there was Cronquist classification. Now, it was on a very broad scale. It was on the broad scale of the subclasses. But that's the system, and I can't remember who it was. It was Ron, who was the? Ron Lyser, that's right. It was the person from the university involved with it. I think it might have been retired at the time. But so it was laid out according to Cronquist classification. And if you go out into the systems garden now, that is largely the system that you will see the order of the plants in today's systems garden. The orders of the monocotyledons are basically around the gazebo, also with the magnolias around one side. The hammer mallards are along the beech hedge near the glasshouses. Then there are the rosids and the asterids near the over near to the sort of the Tin Alley Botany building. And there are a few other groups of plants as well. So Cronquist classification. Well, what's happened since Cronquist is that in the last couple of decades, we've moved into what we can really talk about as the modern era of classification. And the modern era of classification has been driven by a number of things. A new methodology, a new way of determining groups based on very specific defined characters. I'm not going to go into it, but it's an area known as cladistics. We've got a whole lot of new evidence, and that's the evidence from DNA sequences. You know, the ability to sequence DNA and use the arrangement of the bases as characters, which has come from new technology. And the third one is the development of computing methods that have allowed us to analyse and compute these huge data sets. And these three things together have just revolutionised our modern systematics since Cronquist. One of the things that's revolutionised is that it's almost beyond the capacity of individuals nowadays to present classifications on their own. There's just so much data and so much analysis that's required. And it's led to systematists getting together to form consortia. And the major consortia going around at the moment is the Angiosperm Phylogeny Group, which is an international consortia of plant systematists that are collaborating and combining their information. I want to just mention one person here, Mark Chase. He's the keeper of the Jodrell Laboratory at Kew. He really kicked this off with a big molecular or DNA study of chloroplast DNA of flowering plants back in the 1990s. They've got a whole group together collaborating, and he's been a major player in this Angiosperm Phylogeny Group. The Angiosperm Phylogeny Group publish a classification and these branching diagrams every few years. It's pretty small here. I don't expect you to remember this. It's not going to be on the exam. I'm so used to saying that in this room. But you'll see straight away that we've got a different look to the classification. One of branching diagrams where the orders of branching reflect their relationships. And what to say about these? First of all, I should say that there are two things. One is that they're starting to be taken up every now and then when APG produces a new classification. They're starting to be taken up as now the basis of classifications of things. So the new standard flora of the British Isles by STACE is being arranged according to APG3, which is the last but one classification from the group. They also publish a list of classification, and the herbarium at Kew is rearranging its collection according to the system of APG. And as one of the premier institutions, they of course should be one of the ones taking the lead, especially since they've been using Bentham and Hooker, so they have been dragging their chain for the better part of 150 years. Yeah, I've only got a couple more. There are two things to be taken out of these sort of new era of systematics. One is that some of the broad patterns are more or less the same, and of course the old guys got it right some of the time because they put things together that look the same, and looking the same is in general quite a good indicator of relationships. But there are a number of things that have really revolutionised our understanding of plants that have come out of these classifications. One is what's primitive for flowering plants? Right, and we now are pretty confident that it's this group of plants that contains Amborella, a little plant from New Caledonia, the water lilies, Elysium, which is what we get star anise from. Water lilies was an unusual one to have down here at the base. But also that Triphuria, a little plant that was once considered over near the grasses that only probably a handful of people were even interested in, is now a water lily, not a monocot. And so that tells us something about or another avenue to go and look at water lilies. And one that's closer to our hearts here in Australia, that the Proteaceae, the family that has Banksias and Grevilleas, which Cronquist put in the Rosidae, doesn't go there at all. It belongs with plane trees and the Lumbo, lotus. How weird is that? Now, lotus we still don't understand, but when we go back and have a look at Platanus and Proteaceae, there are some things there that make some sense. So in the true scientific sense, these modern classifications are bringing up new hypotheses of relationships that we can go and test using other things. Now, I wanted to just finish on a note that brings us back to the University of Melbourne. What McCoy started here with systematic teaching and a systems garden, of course, we're still doing here in the University of Melbourne. We have a really prominent plant systematics research group, which has been championed over the last 35 years by Pauline Laudegas, and is now run by Mike Bailey and his research group. We've got Joe Birch, the new curator of the herbarium. They're doing plant systematics with these modern molecular methods. We have a university herbarium, which has a fantastic collection of plants, all laid out according to a system. You're probably all dying to know which system. Alphabetically by family. Because the alphabet hasn't changed since the Greeks, and neither have we. And it doesn't. We don't care where anyone puts the families. We don't have to move them. But we think of herbaria as dusty old places with plant collections, but we're now databasing the information on those specimens that's available to anybody through these huge databases. We're making high quality digital images of the specimens. These are also available. And so these systematic research and our natural history collections still underpin scientific research today, because evolution is the paradigm for modern biology. Evolution requires understanding of relationships, and systematic biology allows us to discover those relationships. So what McCoy started in 1856 with his systems garden, we're still doing today here at the University of Melbourne with systematics teaching research and the herbarium. Thank you.
We have time for questions, but like I said, we've got morning tea down there, G26 and G27, where we can keep talking. Is there any specific questions for the moment? You're going to go up with your
I am. But can I ask one question? Yeah. what, in your opinion, is the importance of having, is there an importance of having a system garden now with the way classification is changing so rapidly?
I think there is, because any system is better than no system, that's to start with. Cronquist's system at the level of subclasses is still pretty well holds up, even when you look at the modern classifications from APG. Yeah, we still have the subclass Magnoliids, and that doesn't exist in APG. But even in Cronquist's classification, he recognised that as a paraphyletic group. And what's changed is really just how we consider the different group. So as long as you understand that changes in system are not such a problem. It would be perhaps worse if we still had Linnaeus' system.
Yeah.
But having Cronquist's system is still very functional. No, and it's not hugely detailed. It's at a level of subclasses, and so that's just fine. So keep planting, Tim. Keep planting.
Tim has to go and click the switch on the urn again.
I was just wondering, was the translation from Balfour to Cronquist just one step?
Yeah, there was about 90 years there where there was no classification of the garden, I think it was probably fair to say. So we did resurrect it. It really required a sort of rebuilding of the garden, but it needed it. And so it wasn't that hard to do it. It's not totally systematic, because you'll see that there's still a bed out there of sort of more arborescent monocots, the one that's got the bamboo in the middle. And then we've got a rainforest bed in the corner between the buildings. So it's not strictly systematic, because it, of course, has to serve as an amenity garden for the university, and we needed to preserve those amenity values and the landscape values. And we were able to do that, but still get a systematic overlay in there. I'm not going to usurp Mueller, I don't think, right here in front of everybody, but yes, we did know.
Yeah. Any other questions of Andrew? Yes.
With humans, you look at the mitochondrial DNA, you look at the dispersion, and I don't know how mitochondrial DNA is inherited in plants. Are people using?
Yes, people use.
Go down the female.
Yes, line? Yes. And people use, for plants, nuclear DNA, mitochondrial DNA, and also chloroplast DNA. So there are three DNA sets in plants which are independent, and they're all used.
And usually the chloroplast is down the maternal line.
Oh, hooray.
Well, it makes a challenge for some of the phylogenetic analyses. And the nuclear genome is so large that's the hardest one to do. We have people here who are looking at various genomes of plants, and chloroplast and mitochondria is smaller, right? And easier, relatively.
Yeah.
Well, would you join me in thanking our two speakers? Tim reminds me that we are going to try and have the talks up on the System Garden website at some stage so that people could access it, listen to it again, read a script if that's what's provided by our speakers. This is the last of our talks, and I just really personally wanted to thank Tim, who has driven this whole 3 days of programs. We've still got a bit more to do today with tours still continuing on the System Garden and the herbarium. But Tim, thank you so much for organising. I think it's given a great profile about the System Garden and our herbarium and botany. So let's thank Tim. And tea, coffee and some cookies down in G26.